that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. Whatever the virtues of the many fields of knowledge, all are steps on the path of omniscience. May these arise in the clear mirror of intellect. O Manjushri, please accomplish this. Good evening, welcome. So we thought we might do a quick check-in, see how people are doing with this material, with this course, with this idea of focusing on the view, cultivating an understanding of the nuance of the view as being an essential aspect of the path and the way that we've been trying to go about it. So when I mentioned that, basically everybody emailed me and said they have a lot to say about this. So I'll just go around alphabetically and choose people. Just kidding. Chris, how's it going for you?
It's good. We don't often get an opportunity, at least in the sanghas that I think a lot of us run in, to do this sort of real deep, you know, philosophical work, really trying to understand in a technical sense what these various traditions are talking about. So I've been enjoying getting into the nitty gritty, and also at the same time, sometimes struggling with relating it to personal practice and not having it devolve into just sort of a parlor game, you know, intellectual puzzles to solve.
Yeah. I've been having a fairly similar experience of, I've been wanting to do this sort of course for a long time of like overview of all the different players in the field of the development of the understanding of reality in the Buddhist tradition. And so it's been enjoyable for me in that way. Certain parts of it have not been easy. Westerhoff, I don't really, I like Westerhoff parts of it, but other parts I have a hard time with. And I'm sort of excited to jump in tonight to Buddha Politis, since I've been wanting to read him for a long time. And then, yeah, how does it impact our life and our view? Just trying to like see how does my idea of what's going on impact the way I experience what's going on, basically. Anyone else? Is it too boring, too slow, too much material, too foreign, too pedantic, too orange, too yellow, too scholarly, too... Mary Beth.
Well, I'm just going to admit that I feel similarly lost in this class as I often feel in many of our classes. So I suppose in that regard, it feels right on target.
Par for the course, all right.
Yeah, and then like just one little, you know, shred, one little thing that someone will say, maybe random, offhand, remark, and it'll be the thing that helps me relate it to my practice. So I feel like it would be wrong to think that all of it is going to be relatable, but if just like one little speck. So I say let's keep going.
Right. I love that spirit of life.
Hang in there.
Yeah.
Keep the faith. Thank you, and thank you both, because I know it's challenging to, yeah, it's challenging
To
topic.
pretend we know what we're talking about.
It's not what I'm saying to lead
You
us through it.
know, we I think we all wish that what we're reading could magically be understood and translated to our practice. But I have a feeling that a lot of this tradition is a matter of just training your mind to become accustomed to think about what's going on in a certain way. And that doesn't immediately have any major fruit, any major result. But just over the years of going through this material of thinking about getting caught up in things and then shifting and then well, I don't know, it just creates a different reference point, I think, over time, the material, as opposed to specifics for me of like, oh, but interesting. Thank you for that, Mary Beth. Emily.
I just wanted to say, in appreciation of what we've been doing, that I find it really helpful. Even though a lot of the material we've gone through up until this point is not really stuff we would bring into our practice in a literal way per se, it's been very helpful for me. Because when we read later stuff, the question always arises for me, and I think others, of like, what is the context in which this was written, and who, why are they bringing up these topics? And who are they sort of reacting? Who are they writing these in reaction to? I remember this a couple of years ago, we were reading Nagarjuna, and we were all like wondering why he was bringing up the topics he was. And it's like, who is he refuting or debating against or what? And I do think that understanding that more thoroughly adds a lot of helpful, I don't know, it makes the later things that I do try to bring into my practice have a lot more context and relevance. So I have been finding that, yeah, it's, you know, it's dense and kind of confusing, but I'm also like, it's connecting a lot of dots for me for some of the material that I know is to come, and I find that very helpful.
I really
Cool.
appreciate that, Emily. As Derek and I were putting this class together, we sort of put the cart before the horse. You know, we had this text from the 19th century, Mipham text, that we wanted to discuss, and we realized we needed more and more context, and gradually that turned from two classes of context to like 20 weeks of context in order to get there. So I'm glad to hear that you kind of see where this is going and that it's being helpful. I mean, I've certainly found in revisiting Nagarjuna with really fresh exposure to the Abhidharma material, that it makes a lot more sense what he's talking about. And I hope that we will continue to find that the tradition is constantly referencing itself and informing itself, and that, you know, there's hopefully going to be some sort of through line. Christopher. Chris, was there something you wanted to say?
Are they keeping it open in space and time?
Oh, yeah.
Anyone else? And then we'll come back to Chris. Chris, maybe turn off your video.
No, it's just finding the mute button on my phone. So,
Funny how hard it is on the phone.
yeah, it is. It's like they hide everything. Like, stop doing that. Just show me the buttons. So, yeah, like Mary Beth, I find when I do the reading, it's hard to follow, but at the same time, does make me think about how is my mind working and what is its relationship to the external world. And so even though I'm confused, it does seem to be doing its job, I guess is the way to put it. I mean, I don't mind being confused. I'd like to be able to have time to do more of the reading, but when I do the reading in class, it definitely does something.
Cool. Yeah, time to read and contemplate and absorb. Anyone else?
Yeah, Steve.
I sent you a note a few hours ago. I like examples. And so if, you know, whenever anybody uses an example, you know, like take a match lighting a candle or something like that. Here's the philosophical problem with our normal way of thinking about it. That helps a bit. Not, I mean, it's not the be all and end all, but to the extent that I think several people have mentioned, you know, your actual, how might this relate to your actual experience? I find that helpful. When a few times Westerhoff does that, and I find that that's always very helpful, but a lot of the time he's going from one four-syllable philosophical word to another. And in fact, I've started my own little glossary of, you know, of those words so that I can look them up yet again and find out what the hell he's talking about. So
oh, that's great. Maybe you can share that with us at some point. Westerhoff-isms. It's like Gunther-isms.
Well, all I do is just type it into Google and, or, you know, into Safari, and I find out what epistemological means again. Oh, yeah. Oh, okay. So I just copy paste and put it in my list.
Yeah.
I'm happy to send it around if people want. It's nothing fancy. And it's to be continued.
Yeah, it's ongoing because we'll keep coming back to it.
Yeah, I didn't start this until a few classes in.
Yeah, so it'd be good to go back if you or someone else can. He had some very odd terms. Unusual terms. Let's see.
I think part of the challenge with Westerhoff is that, you see this with Gunther too, is that he's using sort of termed arts of like both Buddhist, you know, thought and also Western philosophical thought. It's sort of his project is using the tools of Western philosophy to understand Buddhist philosophy. And in the process, he is drawing from two separate, you know, pools of jargon. So it can be challenging to get through.
Yeah, it's why you wonder, like, you know, who's the audience for this? And it's probably mostly philosophers, I think he says somewhere the educated reader. Maybe that was in that interview that you sent around a link to, Chris. But like who is he writing for? But he's clearly not writing for practitioners.
It's interesting you say that because, like, I keep hoping that ultimately he is, and that there's a point where practitioners become interested in what scholars like him, how they're understanding this stuff.
Oh, I mean, I think we are, but I don't know that we're the audience.
Oh, the primary audience, yeah.
Yeah, and he does mention it in a couple places, which I was glad to see, that at some point, you know, sort of logical analysis breaks down, and that's where, you know, Dharma teachers and people who have practiced for a long time have something to say. You know, he actually uses those people as sort of an example of, you know, where this would continue after the after the stuff goes, after he's made all the philosophical points. And also, I always look, every time I pick up one of these books, I always look at the bibliography and see how many Tibetan or Thai or whatever teachers are quoted. And, very few. It's mostly
Scholars.
other scholars,
Interesting. That's an interesting observation. Yeah, he's definitely, it's Oxford Publications, right? Oxford Press is the publisher, so that's sort of his audience.
One last thing. Garfield has a new book out, which I read recently. It's in an effort to talk about this stuff for almost complete newbies. I can send a title around, and I thought it was pretty interesting, but that too sort of broke down at some part. But it's an idea to basically write about Nagarjuna's ideas without talking about him that much.
Yeah, Westerhoff also has a book that is very much part of that project called The Non-Existence of the Real World, which is like if you think this book is tough, and he's that I think that's a book that's really written for other people in the academic field of philosophy. But what he's trying to do is a kind of contemporary take on Madhyamaka without using any Buddhist terminology whatsoever. So exclusively using the devices and tools of Western philosophy to accomplish hardcore anti-foundationalist project. So I don't know if you're into this. I can send you a PDF.
But I thought Steve said that he wrote Garfield came out with a book that's for non-scholars. That sounds very
I
different than
just looked it up.
Westerhoff's.
It's called Losing Ourselves by James Garfield. It's not that hard to read. It's worth, if you want a perspective that's a little more, less philosophical, less jargon,
Right.
it's not bad. Like, for example, instead of using the table example of to show that the term table is contingent. He uses government as an example. But we talk about government, but what's the government? What is government? You can't point to a particular, if you say government, you can point to parts of a government, and then it's sort of, all the way down. But I think it's his effort to try to communicate to semi-regular people. It's not bad.
Cool. Anyone else?
I just had an additional thought on Westerhoff, maybe a slight devil's advocate view. I agree that the terminology, like Derek, you said sort of at the beginning of class, he needs a good editor, and that's sort of my view on it. I actually appreciate the approach he's taking because I do think this feels to me like he's trying to take a very scholarly approach, but then turn it into something we can actually think about ourselves in our own lives, which does feel to me different than a purely academic book. But his sentences are so long, as and the words are so big, unnecessarily so. Like, that's what I'm kind of balking at. But I certainly find parts of what he has to say clarifying if I can take the time to slowly read through his long sentences and look up the words I don't know. I guess that would be my view on it. But I mean, whenever we read Wollstone Fletcher, which I always feel this way about him, I find his introductions to be like ideal in terms of that straddling that divide.
I so much prefer those myself too. Yeah, he's good. Rob.
Well, I'd like to express appreciation for this class. It certainly has been a stretch, to think about these things. What I've been finding helpful is that it's, or at least what I feel like is maybe I'm taking it the wrong way, maybe I'm not reading it correctly, but it seems like this class is a concerted effort to take the substance out of reality.
So it's lighter, so you can carry it with you.
Just recognizing the ineffability of our existence, which I think is the primary reason I even ended up on this path, because I didn't know what the hell was going on.
That's great. Thanks.
So primarily this particular class has been, you know, it's been more off the cushion than on the cushion kind of help. It's been more like, you know, just sort of like, when I fall into, you know, a lot of conceptual thinking, this class sort of has helped me realize I'm not necessarily the author of that. So that's sort of where I'm at with it, you know. Yeah, it's been more of like this last reading, you know, the deconstruction of an event. That's kind of
conditions.
You know, I mean, it's, you know. So it's more off the cushion, you know, rumination is what it's doing for me.
Cool.
I think that you know, the tradition does talk about the three trainings, the three prajnas of hearing, contemplating, and meditating that we've talked about before. And it feels like this class is very much a lot about the hearing and a little bit about the contemplating. I think that those three being separate is important here, that you don't immediately get the juice, that you first have to think very deeply about this stuff. Well, first you have to learn about it and kind of understand the arguments, and then you can think very deeply about it. And once you sort of have an understanding of it, at that point, it can show up on the cushion, but it's not an immediate thing. And also, you know, I think even that framework puts it a little more linearly than I experience it, of you sort of grapple with this stuff and it's kind of kicking around in the back of your mind, and then sort of slowly, slowly, drip by drip, it sort of seeps into your practice, rather than a right away sort of thing. And not just your practice, but sort of shows up throughout your life of, you know, you're in the kitchen doing the dishes and all of a sudden it's, well, what am I doing here? What are these dishes? And what, how did it go from dirty to clean? So yeah, I don't know.
Chris, just clean them.
I honestly
stop
feel like
thinking about them. Just
I
clean
feel like
them.
Dishes are the only thing I do. I don't understand how there can be so many.
Anyone else that hasn't spoken, we can always revisit this. Okay, so let's dive in. So I think we worked out that Chris is going to give us a little reminder of the biography of Buddhapalita and his place in this solar system. And then I'm going to read through the preliminary section, and then we'll go through the first chapter and very carefully in great detail. And sometime around midnight, we'll probably finish. Go for it, Chris.
So my job's going to be really easy here, since very little is known about Buddhapalita. He was born in sometime around the 5th or the 6th century of the Common Era, so a few hundred years after Nagarjuna. And the work that we read tonight, the Mula Madhyamaka Vritti, which is his commentary on the Mula Madhyamaka Karika by Nagarjuna, is the only work that we have of his that's preserved. There are, according to Taranatha, there are other commentaries that he composed, but none of them have survived. He really represents, I'm just going to read a quote from David Seyfort Rigg. Rug, who's a scholar. Ruig, Ruig, thanks.
David Ruig.
Dave Ruig, our guy Dave. He says Buddhapalita represents a conservative current of the Madhyamaka thought that resisted the adoption of logico-epistemological innovations, which were at the time being brought into Mahayana's philosophy by, for example, Dignaga. Thus, he did not make use of independent inferences to establish Madhyamaka statements, and he employed the well-established Pasanga method, which points out the necessary but undesired consequence resulting from a thesis or proposition intended to prove something concerning an entity. From the Madhyamaka standpoint, this method has the advantage of not committing the critic who uses the Pasanga to taking up a counterposition and maintaining the contradictory of what he has denied, which as a Madhyamaka he would never consider to be just as faulty as the position he was negating. Buddhapalita's procedure appears accordingly to be in keeping with Nagarjuna's, as expressed in the Mula Madhyamaka Karika and the Vigaravaivaratani. Forgive the pronunciation. So, with that, why don't we dive in? Derek.
Vigraha Vyavartani. So, I love that idea of thinking about, like, so for us, we're in the 2025, and so for Buddhapalita, he was writing about somebody who lived like 300 to 400 years earlier. So, who in our world philosophers lived 300 to 400 years earlier? Any favorites? When was like Rousseau or Descartes or those guys? Who was in like the
So Kant would be about 300 years ago.
Kant? Okay, him
Yeah.
again.
Him again.
Has anyone read Kant?
Yeah.
Anyone else?
I mean, talk about people who needed an editor.
Yeah. Anyone else in that time period, or was there not much else that has survived from that time period?
Well, it wasn't like Newton around then,
Same time period.
or not Kant. Newton was like 400 years ago,
Interesting.
and then Spinoza was around then too, right? And
Okay.
he got into metaphysics some. I mean, he kind of flavored the whole Enlightenment a little bit.
Yeah.
And they
Yeah, I was
chased
going
us
to say
out of
this was
town
like
for it.
right around Enlightenment, wasn't, right, sort of right before Enlightenment philosophy that led to the French Revolution and the American Revolution, right? I don't know my Western philosophy that well, but that would have been right in the middle of the 18th century.
Anyway, so thinking about that, the Buddhapalita is writing about somebody who lived a few hundred years earlier, and in his world, it doesn't seem like it's that different, right? He just seems to be picking up the same rhythm and just extrapolating it in more detail. But what was the thing that Chris just read, where Ruig says he just very much continues the theme or the style of Nagarjuna? Certainly not the Karikas. The Karikas is like this cryptic poetic thing, and Buddhapalita is anything but poetic. More like the Vigraha Vivartini, which was like a dialogue of constant like objection and response back and forth. But
well, I think the point he was making was that he's using the same sort of philosophical argumentation, the Prasanga style.
Yeah, that is the main thing that everybody says about him. Okay, so let's look at page 17, the preliminary in Sanskrit, the Buddhapalata Mula Madhyamaka Vritti in the Tibetan Umatsawe Drelpa Buddhapalata. I pay homage to the three jewels, I pay homage to the youthful Manjushri, I pay homage to the master Arya Nagarjuna, I pay homage to the master venerable Buddhapalata. What do you make of that, that he pays homage to himself? Does that mean that someone else wrote that? Like, is that from the translator, you think? Because this is translated from the Tibetan, right? It's hard to imagine.
I think it'd have to be someone else.
An addition, yeah. It was probably the first three lines, and then the translator probably added that. I don't know, that'd be just sort of odd. The Master Nagarjuna sees the profound state of dependent origination perfectly as it is, with a mind full of amazement. I found that very surprising. With a mind full of amazement. I don't think I've ever seen that sort of description.
I mean, this whole paragraph, it's just dripping.
It's very unusual. With a mind full of amazement, he is inspired to reveal dependent origination to others. Thus, with eyes moist with tears of faith and his body here standing on end, that traditional presentation of what real devotion does to you, he joins his palms and raises them to his crown. Hey, while we're doing this, if there's one person that would volunteer to find, we didn't include in here the Buddha's presentation of Pratitya Samutpada. And there's a reference to that language later on that we might may or may not get to. Any volunteers to Google that and come up with the sutra on dependent origination, where he says, when there's ignorance, then there's samskara, and when there's samskaras. Any volunteers? Steve, nailed it. Thank you. Thus with eyes, let's see. Then he proclaims the following verses to the holy guru Tathagata, as if Shakyamuni were there before him, verses that reveal the ultimate truth that the Tathagatas are in fact the Dharmakaya. So that's how he understands the next verse, which I thought was really interesting, that it reveals that the Tathagatas are the Dharmakaya. And reminiscent of the Buddha's, towards the end of his life, he said, don't worship my body. If you want to see the Buddha, look at the Dharmakaya, not the physical body of the Buddha. I pay homage to the perfect Buddha, supreme among teachers who taught dependent origination. So this is Nagarjuna's opening dedication, right? That is without cessation, without arising, without annihilation, without permanence, without coming, without going, without distinction, without identity, that is peaceful and fully pacifies all fabrication. I pay homage to the perfect, complete Buddha who is supreme among teachers and who taught this supremely profound ultimate truth called dependent origination, that is without cessation, without arising, without annihilation, without permanence, without coming, without going, without distinction, without identity, the supremely profound ultimate truth. He taught the true path that is peaceful, leads to the city of nirvana, and fully pacifies all mental fabrications to those in the world who wander in the dense proliferation of theories regarding a creator, time, atoms, essential nature, intrinsic reality, and so on, due to their adherence to the existence of a prior cause. So he names the culprit, the belief in a prior cause. And so laying the ground for the reasoning of the first chapter of the Mula Madhyamaka Karga, focusing on causation, And the whole text basically focusing on the Bhagawan, the Buddha, i.e. the Buddha fully understands all non-Buddhists who oppose perfect view to be like deceived children. And he taught dependent origination to just such blind reincarnating beings who grope in the darkness. Master Nagarjuna called you supreme among teachers since you see perfectly. Nagarjuna states, without cessation means that cessation does not exist, and this should be applied to the remaining seven characteristics in just the same way. So there's a list of eight characteristics of the ultimate nature, the ultimate reality, starting with without cessation. And that eight characteristics shows up in a number of places, such as the Prajnaparamita Sutras. These verses resemble passages from Sutra, i.e. Prajnaparamita Sutras, and the rest of Nagarjuna's treatise explains the meaning of these verses. Moreover, these chapters, so he interprets the whole Karikas as a commentary on that opening stanza. Moreover, these chapters provide multiple access points to the subject matter according to one's preference, and their order should not be taken as fixed. Objection. So we're in like this very sort of poetic opening stanza, and then it's like somebody like objects. We're in like a courtroom suddenly. Excuse me. What need is there to teach dependent origination? Response: the compassionate master saw that sentient beings are still harassed rather by various types of suffering. Thus, in order to liberate beings, he generated the wish to give proper instruction on the perfect reality of things. For it is said, those who see what is untrue as real are bound. Those who see what is true are liberated. Question: what is the true reality of things? It's a good question. Just like, get right to the point. Response: it is the lack of any intrinsic reality. That is the true reality of things. But for those who are untrained, the eye of intelligence is obscured by the darkness of delusion. If things are conceived to possess an intrinsic reality, this gives rise to attachment or aversion to them. But whenever dependent origination appears to the mind, the darkness of delusion is eliminated, and the eye of wisdom sees that things lack any intrinsic reality. At that time, attachment and aversion do not arise for things that are impossible. So, you know, just briefly, the path of Madhyamaka is to use logic to undermine the possibility of any object of attachment. Right? The path of Vajrayana is to undermine attachment. Not to distract you, but okay. But whenever dependent origination appears to the mind, the darkness of delusion is eliminated, and the eye of wisdom sees that things lack any intrinsic reality. At that time, attachment and aversion do arise. I read that, sorry. Thus, for example, when the thought arises that the reflection of a woman is a woman, attachment is strongly generated, and the mind craves for union with her. But when one realizes the true state exactly as it is, the thought of a woman ceases. Freed from lusts, one feels great shame for having thought about wanting to have union with a woman, and one blames, or the opposite sex, and one blames one's ordinary aura for, not the opposite, for the desired sex, and one blames one's ordinary mind for generating lust for something that does not exist. One blames one's ordinary mind. Shame and blame. So, like, you know, today is very popular not to have, to be kind to yourself and not to give yourself a hard time for being attached and things like that. But they didn't seem to mind doing it. Yeah. Using that technique. Yeah.
It seems that that's touching on how we have what our own relationship is to our own conceptual mind. You know, like, we sort of like own what's happening. Right split second, we own it. As soon as the thought pops out, we think we authored it.
Yeah, so this technique of like talking to yourself as like two people,
Yeah.
like your understanding and your automatic emotions as two different people in you is a theme that comes up throughout the tradition. Shanti Deva is famous for this, talking to himself, like yelling at himself and scolding himself for being so attached to things. The Bhagavan stated on many occasions, monks do not view the internal female organ as real. Monks, when near a female, do not view the internal female organ as real. Because of that, Master Aryadeva, Nagarjuna's student, also stated, consciousness is the seat of existence. Objects are its object field. When objects are seen to be selfless, the seed of existence ceases. So undermining the possibility of real objects, Chris.
This is just a bit of etymology and maybe trivia, but I think there may be something kind of interesting here. So he says the Bhagavan stated on many occasions, monks do not view the internal female organ as real. And I found the use of the honorific Bhagavan to be sort of interesting here. And I'm going to read you how Red Pine, in his translation of the Diamond Sutra, explains the term Bhagavan. The term Bhagavan was derived from bhaga, meaning vulva, and originally meant like a vulva, and hence fecund or prosperous. Eventually, it was applied to one whose presence bestows prosperity. It is usually translated as blessed one or world-honored one, and is one of
Oh, right in the middle there, he freezes. It is one of various epithets of the Buddha.
One of
Chris
every
is
Buddha.
back.
Oh, one of every
You
Buddha's.
froze.
Sorry. One of every Buddha's 10 titles was how that sentence ends. I just thought that was like, it was there's almost like a pun happening here, where, using the female organ honorific for the Buddha while talking about the non-existence of the female organ. He may, and this may not be intentional, but there's a read of this that he's saying something about the non-existence of the Bhagavan as well. You're muted, Derek.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for that, Chris. Although he doesn't say a non-existence, he says not real.
Thanks. Thanks for clarifying that.
Master Nagarjuna, on page 20, composed this treatise in order to fully demonstrate the lack of any intrinsic reality of things. Objection. Your Honor, if the Tathagata, who knows everything, sees everything, possesses great compassion, it's already explained and clearly delineated dependent origination of various beings in different ways. What need is there for Nagarjuna to repeat his clear presentation? What a funny interjection. Like, that's a sense of humor, in addition to using, as what Chris pointed out, the terminology in the last section, playing with that. Response. Indeed, it's true that Tathagata himself has already explained, clearly presented dependent origination, but now those who explain and teach such terms as arising and so on are influenced by their common usage. And with minds that cling to mere words, they do not comprehend the supremely profound state of dependent origination. So we're talking like a thousand some odd years after the Buddha. And he's chiming in and saying, well, the Buddha taught this perfectly, but people don't understand it. People are misunderstanding it. So I'm here to clarify. Nagarjuna clarified, and I'm going to unpack it for us.
Which is so funny. Like this wasn't the first commentary. It's like
It is funny. Yeah, it was not. They think things in fact exist because they are described as arising and ceasing, or coming and going. They think existent phenomena are permanent or annihilated, identical or distinct. They think non-existent phenomena, such as the horns of a rabbit, do not arise. That's an interesting one. Master Nagarjuna has composed this work reliant on logic and scripture to clearly teach the nature of dependent origination. So he claims that Nagarjuna uses logic, whereas Ruig claims that Buddhapada doesn't use epistemological reasoning. Okay. The Tathagata explained clearly articulated dependent origination for that purpose alone. It's appropriate that Master Nagarjuna later clearly articulated it for just this purpose. How could it be suitable for him to later clearly present what was not explained earlier nor clearly articulated by the Tathagata? So too, it is due to former masters explaining and clearly articulating treatises on worldly topics that their students later teach such treatises. Therefore, it is appropriate that Master Nagarjuna clearly presents this after the Tathagata has already done so. Objection: why do you negate all the terms such as sensation? Can't you merely state without cessation, without arising, without annihilation, without permanence? Just four of them. Just cut things in half. Response: those who advocate that a thing has intrinsic reality teach that the eight terms such as cessation that are primarily taught according to their everyday usage refer to a thing that actually exists. Hence, these eight terms such as cessation are negated. So too, those who theorize about reality or initiate disputes about reality, theorize or dispute in reliance on such terms as cessation, and so on. Here, vaibhashikas. So the translator has added vaibhashika, saying that's who he's talking about. But Apollodorus says here, it's said, you know, more literally, his words, I think, would say, here it is said, all things that possess the properties of arising and cessation are momentary because they arise continuously within a stream. The Vaisheshikas, which is a Hindu school, or what we call Hindu, say the nine substances such as earth are permanent. And you know, we studied the dharmas and how they're made of eight or so particles, one of which is the earth particle. So I think he's comparing these beliefs by placing them together in this way. Also, the Jains say the six substances, such as the principle of motion, rest, space, time, matter, and beings, are permanent. So too, in general, they argue about whether life force and the body, fire and fuel, cause and effect, qualities and those possessing qualities, parts and wholes, are identical or distinct. Furthermore, the Samkhya say, those who possess the three qualities in action are said to eternally cycle. Others say, neither atoms nor the mind function. The Jains assert, both beings and matter possess movement. Once established, they proceed upwards. Therefore, he negates the eight terms such as cessation, since it is due to them that beings theorize and initiate disputes about reality. Those terms, I guess. Objection: why is cessation negated first and arising negated later? I think it is logical to state without arising, without cessation. Did anyone else have that thought at any point? It was like, why is the order like seemingly mixed up? I thought about that. So I love this part. Response: the original order should not be faulted. Why? Because those skilled in language ascertain how priorities applied according to grammatical rules, but others do not ascertain this. If arising exists, cessation will occur. But if arising does not exist, cessation will not occur. That's the objection. Therefore, in accordance with the proper order, first arising must be stated. Response, friend. What do you think of that? Calling him friend, calling the other person friend. Is that like patronizing or trying to be friendly? Give an example that would generate conviction in your assertion arising is earlier and cessation is later. Can you objection? Anything could serve as an example. In what way, for instance, like the statement, birth is pointless. Why? Because when birth exists, then enemies such as aging and death, illness and suffering, killing and bondage exist. Response. But some think that death precedes any birth for which death exists, right? If we look at the 12 Madonnas as the example of Pratitya Samutpada, death leads to the next cycle, right? Which includes birth. If death does not precede birth, then it would absurdly follow that samsara would have a beginning, but that is unacceptable. Therefore, samsara has no beginning or end. It cannot be stated that birth is first and death follows, or death is first and birth follows. Also, Nagarjuna states below, if birth were to occur earlier and aging and death later, birth would be without aging and death, and birth would arise even without dying. Objection, but if birth is devoid of such perils, then birth would not be pointless, just as if trees do not grow, then a forest would not exist and it would not be harmed by wind. This is another example. Response, what is the difference? Objection, there is a difference because something that arises after ceasing does not exist. For there's no tree that has ceased elsewhere but then arises here. Response, in this regard, since a sprout arises after the seed ceases, it only arises due to the seed ceasing earlier. Right, so the objection was like thinking that there's a real end to phenomena, and Buddhapalata is going like to the total opposite, almost extreme or alternative of like, well, things arise in a sequence, and that sequence doesn't happen if the prior member doesn't disappear. Objection, this is not similar. Why? Because when one has ceased, another arises. Thus, when the seed ceases, the sprouts arise. But since the sprout does not arise when the seed since the sprout does not arise when the sprout has ceased, it's not similar. Response, that is entirely similar. Why? Because both birth and death are also like this, and the one who dies is not the one who is born. If the very one who dies were the one who is born, then it follows that person would be permanent. And one who is a god would only become a god, and one who is an animal would only be an animal. But one should not assert this, since rebirth and reincarnation produced by karma and affliction are unmistaken. Thus, you cannot assert just the one who dies is the one who is born. And this is entirely similar. Also, here it is illogical to state just the one that ceases is the one that arises. If both the seed and the sprout were absolutely unrelated, the two would not exist as cause and effect, even nominally. But since they nominally exist as cause and effect, these two are not absolutely unrelated. Again, in this world, someone may say, I planted the seed and I grew this tree. I produced the sun. This tree is mine, and this sun is mine. But if the seed and tree and the father and son were absolutely unrelated, such worldly expressions would be impossible. But since such expressions are possible, it cannot be stated that both the seed and tree are absolutely unrelated. Nagarjuna states below, that which is different in dependence on others. If others do not exist, others would not be different from it. It is untenable that something dependent on another is different from it. It is untenable that something dependent on another is different from it. This whole idea of like otherness is a big thing, because for otherness to have any meaning, there needs to be truly existent phenomena that one is referring to as other or the same.
Like in the Svabhava?
Svabhava, yeah. Objection. Again, on this point, if the seed exists, it will come to cease. Since if it did not exist, it would not come to cease. Therefore, here, rising is earlier and cessation is later. Not giving up. I'm not giving up on this order. Response. Even in this case regarding the seed, the prior cessation of the seed exists. Why? Because the tree is not something other than the sprout, and also the seed is not something other than the tree. Therefore, the sprout arises from the prior cessation of the seed, and even the seed itself arises from the prior cessation of the seed. The tree is not something other than the sprout, and also the seed is not something other than the tree. Therefore, the sprout arises from the prior cessation of the seed, and even the seed itself arises from the prior cessation of the seed. Thus, Master Arya Davis said, just as the end of a seed is seen, though it does not have a beginning, so too birth does not arise when its causes are incomplete. Therefore, since neither arising nor ceasing can be posited as earlier or later, why is it inappropriate to criticize the statement, cessation is negated first, arising is negated later? Because it is clearly taught that those two cannot be posited as earlier or later. You should investigate why Master Nagarjuna here states cessation first and arising later. So he does it intentionally to mess with our idea that those are like sequential things that have, that are part of a beginning and end sequence. And instead that there's an endless becoming. And so the next thing is this first chapter, the critique of conditions, and he focuses
Can we stay in this intro a little while longer?
I was going to, yeah, let me,
okay,
let me
sorry.
Just introduce
well,
it.
Could carry on with what you were going to say then, and I'll jump in.
And so it focuses on this scheme of causation of the four options, and it uses the scheme of the four causes or conditions that are traditionally by Abhidharmaka said to give rise to phenomena, produce, create. But it'd be helpful to pause a minute and like talk about what is the basic premise that is being used in all of this reasoning. There's a certain flaw that's being revealed in the way that we think about things that was just expressed very nicely in this last response. The tree is not something other than the sprout, and also the seed is not something other than tree. Therefore, the sprout arises from the prior cessation of the seed, and even the seed itself arises from the prior cessation of the seed. Chris, so tell us, what does all that mean? What is the flaw that we all, the misunderstanding that we all have that's really being unpacked here in this section, as well as the whole of Nagarjuna's texts?
I think you alluded to it earlier when you talked about the problematic nature of otherness. That if we try to truly sever the tree from the sprout, we're not going to be able to tell a convincing story about how the sprout turned into the tree. If they're entirely different things, why didn't the sprout turn into something else? There has to be some sort of necessary connection between the tree and the sprout. But if we take that further, then the tree and the sprout need to be in some way the same thing, which obviously they aren't. So it's really diving into the inherent contradictions in these common sense ways of viewing identity and causation.
And what is that common sense way of viewing identity and causation that's being refuted, that's being exposed and undermined?
I think it's Svabhava, the idea that there's a there there.
That there's a thing there.
There's a thing. There's such a thing as a tree sprout continuum. that we can make philosophical sense of.
So we continually freeze frame the flow of undifferentiated appearance, let's say, and randomly call it different things at different points in time, and then try to compare those things, those points in time, as if they're separate entities, where there's never any point in time where there's an identifiable entity.
And the Sat Tantricas, which we looked at earlier, really took this to the extreme of the t time is made up of these infinitesimal slices, where an object is continually causing the next moment of itself and also vanishing out of existence at the same time. That's sort of a exaggerated version of this common sense thing that Derek is talking about, that frame one, it's a seed, frame two, it's a sprout, and frame three, it's a tree. And we talk about them as though they're different, but we're going to run into trouble when we try to actually make sense of how they could be different.
Cynthia.
So, while I do understand that there is this flow and that, the freezing it into thing is a problem, when you say undifferentiated experience, I'm just checking to see
Clearing of the throat.
what no no I sorry, that's just my disease that it's can't get away from that. I'm just wondering what you mean when you say undifferentiated experience, in that, if you mean simply that you can't break it into discrete things, okay, I get that. But it's like going from a, let's call it a sprout, to a tree. It's not like those look the same. So in that sense, there's differentiation of what appears, is there not?
Yeah, there's an enormous variety in characteristics,
Although even
right?
that word I understand is a little tricky, because characteristic sort of implies belonging to a thing. But nevertheless, yes, that concept of there is some kind of variety of appearance in some way, right?
Like the way you add the throat clearing. It's very helpful. I know it's not meant that
So
way,
sorry about that.
but actually it works.
Great.
Yeah. So, how are you going to name the difference in appearance between a seed and a tree? I use the
Understood.
word characteristics. I use the word differentiated. There's size, there's shape, there's color, there's.
Right. So I just wanted to know that when we talk about, when you say flow of undifferentiated experience, you don't mean that there's no variation. It's not like experience is a monolith of sameness. It's just that there isn't the ability to slice it up. Is that
Well, you
right?
hit the nail on the head when you said you sort of referenced in a way of saying, I don't want to get into this whole idea of possession of characteristics, right?
Right.
But that's the heart of the issue.
Right. I understand, and that right. But that's why I just want to know, though, what does it mean to say undifferentiated experience? Does that mean are
I
you
said
in
I
between?
appearance. I
Point
said
is that
appearance.
it doesn't mean anything, and our attempts to make it mean something is where we get into trouble. So it's sort of a suspension. What I think is being advocated for is a suspension for the need to explain in some sort of philosophically robust way.
The
So there.
relationship between appearances. And I said
So
appearance is not experience.
appearances is taken really at face value, without an attempt to make it mean anything.
Okay, I guess, because to me, undifferentiated has a really specific meaning, but it tends to make it seem like we're saying, okay, everything is just gray or whatever it might be, you know, that there is, you know, everything is gray and shapeless or whatever, you know, I mean, however you want to, as opposed to being, you know, what I think we perceive is, you know, even if they talk about it as all being colored lights flowing around or whatever, still there's, you know.
I think this is the real challenge with Madhyamaka, is that we're attempting to discredit the opponent's philosophical explanation without proposing a new one in its place. So, you know, Derek talked about the blob, but I don't think he meant the blob or the undifferentiated experience. I called it the blob. that is not meant to be a philosophical theory.
Right. I mean, I just wanted to know, is if what you mean by undifferentiated is, this will sound weird, but unable to be sliced up. If that's what you mean by that, that we can't, you know, break it into pieces, then I get that. But it, undifferentiated to me means like complete sameness. No,
that appearance is ontologically undifferentiable. Undifferentiable.
Right. Okay. So you're talking about it from an ontological point of view, not from an experiential point of view.
That's is that correct. Right?
Okay. That's what I wanted to clarify, because otherwise this is one of those things that you kind of can, I can go so far as, you know, glossing over it, but at a certain point I go, do I really know what you mean? So it's really just this issue of not being able to slice it up into things. Ontologically non.
Slice what up?
Experience, whatever word you want to use.
I'll take a half a pound of whatever that is and a quarter pound of that other thing.
Okay, sorry to, you know.
No, that's great. Let's get right into the heart of the matter. We don't have to go through the excruciating linguistic puzzles necessarily.
Right. No, I just wanted to make sure that I was not,
Are you sure?
Ontological help. So.
So I was talking to a friend about emptiness, and this friend was a scientist, and this friend said, we were talking about like what's the relationship between a tree and a seed, and this scientist said, well, they have the same DNA. The DNA doesn't change between the two of them, right? Where do you, you know, so that's like common sense scientific point of view of like, where does the tree come from? What's the relationship between the tree and a seed? Is that the DNA of the seed programs the growth into a tree? So how do you characterize that in terms of these arguments? Is that production from other, from self, from DNA, from both? You know, just to like get real world, you know, that's what scientists will say. If you start talking in like weird categories of production from self and other, like, no, it's just this DNA that programs how things evolve.
Is it similar in any way to any of the kind of early school ways of trying to weasel into an explanation of how causality can actually work, like, you know, those natures and things like that?
Yeah, we just saw it. There's the nine
and
the three.
A little bit more sophisticated, perhaps.
But yeah, it's very much like he just went through the nine substances, the six substances, the three qualities, right? Chris, what do you think?
It sort of reminds me of the Samkhya. Did he talk? The Samkhya.
Yeah, the three.
The three. So the Samkhya have the idea of, and this is not my specialty,
soup
of Purusha. And
I was going to say that, but I thought, oh, I might get it wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, so Purusha is the sort of undifferentiated pure consciousness from which Prakriti, the material world and all aspects of nature, arise. It's often given as an example of self-causation, of the Purusha and Prakriti are the same, but it's causing itself in a different manifestation.
I'm with you. So with DNA, then it's basically a way of explaining that a tree arises from
From itself.
itself in terms of like there's the DNA and the DNA just morphs through different appearances, through
It's
different
basically a way of
styles.
acknowledging process, with programming. There's this idea of a process by which A becomes B, but then as we're saying, A is really it's really is A just becoming a variation on A, that its programming tells it what to do. It's
Yeah, so are the tree and the seed other?
That's where it gets tricky, isn't
Yeah, what do you think? What do you guys think?
it? Well, is there a definition of what other means?
Of otherness. It's the opposite of sameness.
There's nothing intrinsically different between them. The whole thing. You can't pull out a seed from a tree because you also need soil. You need rain. In order to have rain, you need an atmosphere. For an atmosphere, you need a planet. For a planet, you need a sun. For a sun, you need a galaxy. The whole thing is connected.
Yeah.
That's true, but even with all those elements, a particular kind of seed goes into a particular kind of tree, and the apple seed becomes an apple tree, and the acorn becomes an oak or whatever. So all those other conditions, but with all those other conditions, still, why is it, what
Yeah,
is the, that's the argument for sameness,
but
but
every condition needs all of those conditions.
so let's jump into the next chapter, the critique of conditions. And he introduces he comments on Nagarjuna's opening stanza, not for himself, other, both without a cause, never in any way do any things arise. And he basically dispenses with three of the four options very quickly: self, both, and neither. Is that correct? And then he's going to focus in on otherness. So the objection on page 26, towards the top, we admit the first three points. Things don't arise from themselves, so how then could a sprout arise from itself? If they don't arise from themselves, it's illogical that they arise from both themselves and others, since one part of the thesis we've already disproved, and the proposition arising without a cause cannot be accepted since it's off the charts. But since you strictly maintain the position that things never arise from others, what explanation could justify this? The four conditions, as you and I, responder and objector, both know, that are famous in Abhidharma world, are the causal condition, the objective condition, the antecedent condition, and the dominant condition, and a fifth does not exist. So the chapter goes through the four in each individually, but it begins with going through the four as a set, and then it goes through each individually, right? So, since it said a fifth does not exist, this indicates that the Abhidharma masters, who apparently is the reference point for the objector as truth, strictly maintain that any condition, even those conventionally described as different from the four, must be included within the four. In order to fully settle the issue, these masters teach the four conditions, such as the causal condition, to be the conditions generating things, for things arise from these four conditions alone. Thus, because things arise from these four conditions, which are other than the thing that's produced by the four conditions, therefore it is unsound to assert things never arise from other. Because the Abhidharma master said, things arise from the four conditions, which are other than that which is produced. Okay. Chris, you want to dive in and unpack, read, and then we'll talk about how. I love that he uses Gupta and Chaitra. That's their names, right? Instead of like John Doe and Sally or whatever.
And must have been common names in his time. Kind of a. It's sort of funny. And later when he talks about making the rice gruel, you know, just these like, just like tiny little slice of life moments in this otherwise, you know, technical treatise.
Right, rice gruel must have been the most common food.
Yeah. Glutinous rice. I think they ate glutinous rice a lot. Okay, so. If you designate any of the four conditions, such as the causal condition, as other, and if they were something other than things that they produce, then things would arise from others. But it is untenable to say they are other. In what way? Nagarjuna explains. The intrinsic reality of things does not exist in their conditions, and so on. And I take the "and so on" to mean the other options of the tetralemma here. So they do not exist in their conditions, do not exist not in their conditions, do not exist both in their conditions and not in their conditions, and do not exist in neither their conditions and non-conditions. If their own intrinsic reality does not exist, extrinsic reality does not exist.
So what is he referring to as extrinsic reality? In intrinsic reality. Intrinsic reality is swabhava.
Swabhava.
And extrinsic is a fancy way of saying.
I think it means the swabhava of the other thing.
I'm there.
Yeah. Yeah.
That, so, that must be what it's, what he's the
yeah, if the result, if the result or the, if the thing, if there's no reality in the thing, there can be no reality in the conditions that produce the thing.
Which are other than the thing.
Which are other than the thing.
And let's go back just for a second to Rob. Can you repeat your definition of otherness, which was good?
Huh.
Hard to remember, right? Something about things.
Well, no, it's something I feel more than I logically. It's just all. You can't take a piece of unity out of unity. It's all unity. It's all one thing. So there is no other. And the dance is happening continuously in every direction.
But you've refuted otherness.
Yeah, I know.
I was asking you to define otherness.
Well, there is no otherness. There is no intrinsic otherness. There can't be.
And what do you mean by otherness?
Things out of relationship to whatever the subject of discussion is. There's nothing out of relationship.
Otherness is no common identity. No common.
The whole
ontological ontologicalness, something like that.
The whole situation is anonymous.
We know that. We're just trying to like set the stage for that argument that you're shifting into by saying, what is otherness? Otherness is this idea that there could possibly be phenomena that have absolutely no relationship with each other. Yeah. I think it's really important to define it in that very absolute way.
How would we know?
how does the thermos know?
Yeah, how would we know that there's this thing outside of relationship? How would we?
Oh, don't give it. That's the secret. Okay, yeah, you're giving it away.
Well, I think what Rob is getting at and is important to remember back to those dedicatory verses. This is a text about dependent origination, and the whole point is that you you can't take anything out of the sort of matrix of dependent origination.
Things are produced and arising and existing dependently upon other so-called things, then they have no intrinsic identity of their own. And therefore, no part of that of the so-called matrix has any intrinsic identity. So you can't support otherness.
All a house of cards.
Cynthia, I think. Oh, no. Yeah, so go on, Chris. All a house of cards.
And not even, because there's no card, right?
Yeah, and there's no table.
But there is an ante.
That's right. Time to pay up. Here, existent things may be described as other, since one thing relies on another. Just as, for example, Gupta is other than Kaitra, and Kaitra is other than Gupta. But whenever conditions such as seeds exist, then at that time, things such as sprouts grown from them do not exist. Thus, when conditions... So what he's saying there is, when the seed exists, the sprout does not exist yet, right? Because the seed and the sprout are different. Thus, when conditions such as causal conditions and so on exist, then the intrinsic reality of things such as sprouts does not exist. If their own intrinsic reality does not exist, then how could their causal conditions and so on be other than those things? Hence, it is untenable that conditions, such as causal conditions, are extrinsically other than things such as sprouts. Therefore, because extrinsic reality definitely does not exist, it is untenable to say things arise from others, and so on, as stated in conditions and so on, in order to include the doctrines of others. As such, it is clearly taught that the arising of things is untenable, even with respect to the doctrines of others.
So the main argument here seems to be about the fallible proposition of otherness. That if you identify one thing, that if there is no one thing, then there's no other thing. Something like that.
And I think it's also a critique around what contemporary philosophers might call emergent properties, that you could have a number of conditions without swabhava, and you can't add them up in such a way that swabhava suddenly springs out of them.
Right. Something doesn't come out of nothing. Something never comes out of nothing. Although they have experiments where they have a vacuum, and then suddenly there's something there. Right? Doesn't that disprove that?
Well, no.
It means that their identification of nothing was wrong.
Yeah, that there was never nothing.
There was really something lurking in the vacuum. But the main place they do this is the mind, right? They say the mind emerges from the matter of the brain, and at some point, suddenly this magical creation emerges as an emergent property.
Okay. And that's the end of the explanation.
Which, yes, I've right, always right.
You know, I worked in neuroscience for a number of years, and it's sort of this prevailing view that, you know, it's just like really complicated and we don't understand it, but at some point the mind.
Yeah, at some point you get enough neurons together and it creates complexity, and there you go. There's consciousness. So we don't have much time yet. Do you want to do a little, because maybe do a little bit more and talk about, like, can we identify the technique he's using? Because what I'm curious to see is...
Yeah, I did want to talk about technique, and I wanted to go back a little bit to the introductory, and we don't have to read it, but just talk generally about it. One of the objections was, you know, wasn't this list a little long? Couldn't you have narrowed it down to just four things? And the response is, I'm totally butchering and paraphrasing here, something along the lines of, like, well, yeah, that would have been philosophically sufficient to do, but because there are all these different philosophical schools of thought, we need to sort of address them one by one to take into account their own points of view. And, you know, having never read Buddha Palata before, I had this sort of, you know, cardboard cutout version of Prasanga that, you know, this was only going to be negative statements using this method of exposing your opponent, exposing the logical fallacies of your opponent. And very clearly he's saying, well, we're doing this to help explain this to people. So there, it would be incorrect to say that Buddha Palata has no thesis. You know, he's he lays out several. And I just found that somewhat surprising. But I think that the counter argument would be he doesn't have a thesis of a certain kind. And he doesn't have he doesn't make any thesis about regarding Swabhava. That he's perfectly fine to speak in what this translator calls the nominal sense, you know, talking conventionally. But when it comes to matters of existence, matters of causality, he will make no claims.
Thank you. That's exactly what I was getting at, that I was similarly like surprised that it was so expository and so philosophical. I expected it to be, like you said, just sort of like bada boom. If you say this, that's absurd because of this. And yeah, I was fascinated to see, well, what more does Bhavaveka do that is being considered so dramatically different? Mm-hmm. So we'll see that next week. What else? Any other comments people have? Or Chris, do you have? Yeah, Cynthia.
I just was really, when you were talking about, you know, kind of wrapping up this last set of arguments about no otherness, but that last line, I guess, really struck me about when he says it's clearly taught that that arising is untenable. And so yes. I felt like that to me is also really the crux. It's like, forget about other and self. If there's just, you know, the ultimate is really that no arising.
Well, how does he get there? What's the logic that got him to that conclusion?
I mean, in a sense, it came through looking at all the different forms of causality, I think. So in that sense, it just seemed like it's sort of a very stark reminder, you know.
Yeah. Well, he was refuting otherness, which was the fourth,
right?
The remaining option of birth from
right.
other.
So there's nothing left, basically. Yes.
And that theoretically the conditions are other than what they produce, and that designation of there being conditions that are other than what comes about is not sustainable, and therefore your whole premise.
Right, so this is where the whole carpet gets pulled out.
Yeah, very quickly there. And it does that ad nauseum for the remainder of the chapter to some extent. I think Rob quickly, although Chris had his hand up.
It's interesting how the other thing that we keep talking about that has no arising, abiding, and ceasing is the mind.
Yeah, and they don't focus on the mind here in this tradition. They focus on the object, as I was saying, which is interesting. Chris, Dylan, Christopher.
It made me think of the eternal which Nietzsche talked about and others. And again, now that we've gone through it, it seems right, everything's connected and it just goes around and around. So ultimately you would say there was no big bang or end to the universe. It's just eternally going around and around and around, and everything's commingled. So I thought that was interesting. And then we were talking about how, and that might be his writing, because he does use philosophical terms and stuff. So it might be the translation that made me think of the eternal return.
The eternal return. That's neat. Is that a Christian phenomena of the...
No, I think it's more philosophical. Might even be more alchemical like. Maybe in that category.
So it's not referring to, there's something that's supposed to happen soon where Jesus comes back in the, and like the accounting happens. It's called the...
The end time.
Something.
No, this is more like there is no end time. It's just
what cycle. Comes around, goes around. But you
exactly.
can't say what
there
it
you
is.
Go.
Did anyone else have a comment? Or back to Chris Wilcox. Chris, you want to wrap it up? Add anything more? Hard in 2 minutes to
full rest of this chapter.
Goes on and on.
Yeah, I mean, we could.
How about the consciousness example? Do you want to touch on that by 27? The objector says, "Doesn't consciousness arise when conditions such as material form and so are present?"
Mm-hmm. Response: That is not so. Let's investigate the arising of things. If you assert that consciousness that has not yet arisen, so we're asserting a yet to be arised consciousness. If you assert that consciousness that has not yet arisen arises from conditions that are other than it, then how could consciousness that has not yet arisen possess its own intrinsic reality? Again, how does a non-existent phenomenon borrow an intrinsic reality from conditions? And if its own intrinsic reality does not exist, how could extrinsic reality exist? If the result does not have swabhava, how could the cause have swabhava? And if the extrinsic reality does not exist, then sprouts and so on would similarly be non-existent. Again, there is an alternate meaning. The essential nature of things, swabhava, does not exist in their conditions. It does not exist in those that are other than their conditions. Also, it does not exist in both. Why? What's interesting, he doesn't say neither, right?
Yeah, he left that one out.
He left this, so we have a trilemma. Why? Because to take them as conditions for the arising of another is flawed. It is pointless. To take them as the conditions for the arising of another is flawed. So them is the conditions.
Or is it the essential nature of things?
Is it the essential nature? Well, anyway, let's move on. Thus, if the intrinsic reality of things existed in their condition, or in those other than their conditions, or in both, then what use is it for things that already exist to arise? So this is effectively saying that if the swabhava exists in the conditions, then the thing already exists in those conditions, and thus why would it need to be produced? And so this is effectively folding the argument of other causation into the argument against self-causation.
The pointlessness is the key.
It would be pointless to consider that things exist due to their intrinsic reality need to arise again. What use are conditions for something that already exists? Also, considering them to be conditions would be pointless.
Isn't there a slight difference between, I'm not trying to argue that they're wrong or anything, but when you talk about like multiple conditions and that are necessary in order for this thing to arise, right? And so then they're arguing that if, so I guess the question is, if there's multiple conditions, the whole concept is that these multiple things have to come together in order for this new thing to arise, like what Rob was saying before, you know, soil and earth and sun and all of that have to be there along with the seed. And then you get that tree. So it's not like any one of those things holds the svabhava. It's the collection of all of them. Do they ever deal with that? I don't. Because it's easy if you just simplify it into single cause, single effect. But when we're talking about multiple conditions, it doesn't seem like it's so simplistically.
And I think that's the very reason that he's talking about conditions in this case, is that it's a more complicated picture and one that's maybe a little more sophisticated. But that the same issues apply. And I'm trying to, there is a.
But where is that? I mean, I'm just trying to, I'm playing devil's advocate here somehow, is that
please.
If they're saying that it's pointless because the intrinsic reality already exists, but it doesn't exist in one place. It exists across, you know, five different conditions or something. So I don't quite understand how they're dealing with that aspect.
Say it again. It's pointless because the intrinsic reality already exists?
Well, their argument is that because the intrinsic reality already exists, it's pointless for it to arise again, right? That's the essential point that they're making about all this.
Well, that's one option of arising from self, no?
But I'm just trying to understand that when there's multiple conditions, it means that there isn't one single thing that holds that whole reality. And therefore, I guess I don't quite see how that pointless, like there's no way in which this process makes sense because it's already there. It's not already there yet because it's in five different things that have to come
okay,
together.
Okay, so you're talking about arising from other, not arising from itself.
Well, okay, yeah, I may have misspoken, but it just seems like they're talking about this thing of conditions.
So if you can't prove that one of those conditions contributes a real essence, then having a zillion of them doesn't make it more valid.
And I think a lot of that argument hinges on this idea that we get from Abhidharma, of that swabhava has to be mereologically simple. It can't have parts, right? So
then the whole notion of multiple conditions is flawed.
That's right.
Okay.
Good point.
Okay. That's my only problem with this. I get the idea that if something's already there, it doesn't need to happen again. But I to me, they've talked all the time about having multiple conditions. And so it therefore seems like there's some notion that when you have to bring a bunch of them together in order for all their various
I think
the new svabhava thing.
Yeah, I think what you're getting at is this whole issue of that the Abhidharma system doesn't specifically and fully buy into this idea that svabhava is unchanging, like entity of the essence of some phenomena's existence. But everything they say and describe it logically results in that quality of svabhava. But they use svabhava in a contradictory way. They say that like svabhava is unchanging and yet it's produced.
Mm-hmm. Right, I think we touched on this in some earlier weeks, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
And for them, it's like that contradiction that they don't like. It doesn't fall apart in their minds somehow.
Right.
Like, so well, we know it's there. You know, we see water and we see earth. You know, so you can't deny those. And they weren't there yesterday or whatever, you know. So they have this contradictory view of svabhava as being the true nature of some phenomena, which means it's really unproduced, and yet it's produced. So the subsequent schools, you know, exaggerate the flaw of that thinking by parsing it out and excruciating and very delineating detail. It's like it's cut and dry. It's either this or it's not this.
Right. Although it's interesting that they don't seem to point to what you just did, which I think was very helpful. They seem to go through all these the classic arguments, but they don't
That's
get
true.
like what you're saying doesn't make sense. You know, the you don't have a firm definition here or
Yeah,
whatever
you
it is.
guys are like flitting back and forth. You're schizophrenic. You know, on the one hand,
That
you're
mushy
talking about
stuff. Yeah.
production, and then on the other hand, you're talking about these real entities that are these like constants. And you guys, you're contradicting yourselves. Yeah, it's funny they don't say it in that way. But
But it's helpful when you do, actually. Thank you.
yeah.
Over again, that you know, this is untenable, which is, I think, it's a way of saying like this argument doesn't hold water. It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, it's interesting that they don't. There must be some reason for that. It must be presented in a certain way, in certain context that leads them to focus on a certain mode of refutation.
Rather than just saying you guys are full of baloney.
Yeah, or like saying like, well, you're not being clear, you know, you're contradicting yourselves, and on the one hand you're saying this, and
I mean, it's
anyway.
what typically happens when people try to make a case for Atman in general, too. People start getting very mushy about, you know, yes.
Yes.
it is this, but no, it's not, and it's, you know, it's the same but different, and, you know, you start to get into this mushiness because fundamentally it doesn't work. Logic doesn't work, as the logic proves, but what it really points to is that the initial foundation was weak.
Yeah, and that's why, also by both and neither, actually, we dispense them like, oh, nobody really thinks that. But actually, I think all of us come to this point of like thinking that the self exists in some indescribable way in relation to the skandhas. And so at some point, we're going to get to, maybe with Chandrakirti, I'll share it, where the Tibetan tradition then breaks down these different levels of belief in existence, in between, like, we saw a substantial existence, we saw nominal existence as having the three categories or aspects of continuous, unitary, and independent. And then there's this idea of substantial existence as somehow findable in the skandhas, in relation to the skandhas. And then there's this idea of existing from its own side, which is the mind-only school, that the
Don't you have a
mind.
page of these definitions? I
I
remember from.
do, I do, yeah. So I'll put that up, as well as the beliefs of Prasangikas. That very long list, right? So we should close at this point. And next week we dive in, psh, to Bhava Viveka, right? So happy Thanksgiving, everyone. Have a great time. Hope you survive family scene without tumult and so forth. By this merit, may all attain omniscience, may it defeat the enemy wrongdoing from the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death, from the ocean of samsara, may I free all beings. By the confidence of the golden sun of the Great East, may the lotus garden of the Rigdon's wisdom bloom. May the dark ignorance of sentient beings be dispelled. May all beings enjoy profound, brilliant glory. Thank you, Chris. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you,
Take
Derek.
Thank you,
care.
Derek.
And
Thanks.
just a word of caution about the Bhava Viveka. It is tough going, and I think a sense of humor and gentleness, and don't bust up your drywall by banging your head into it.
That's a great point. And maybe, we basically focused on the first stanza, the comment, so maybe we'll do the same thing and sort of focus on the first stanza of his commentary as well.
I mean, if you can just sort of get a flavor of it and, spend some time just trying to understand one stanza, skim the whole thing, but maybe spend some time really trying to pick apart one stanza would be a good way to read that rather than trying to, deconstruct the entire thing. Unless you want to, in which case, right on.
Great. That's very helpful, Chris. Thank you.
Yeah.
Take
Thanks very
care.
much.
Happy
Bye.
Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving.